You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am back with part two, the finale of Marilyn Monroe, What Happened, Norma Jean. In the first episode, I discuss Marilyn Monroe's tragic life from her birth as Norma Jean Mortensen to her death on August 5th of 1962. And for this episode, I'm going to carry on and discuss her death in more detail. And guys, gonna keep it honest, this is going to be kind of like a light discussion of a variety of different conspiracy theories surrounding her death. And overall, what exactly happened? But before we get into that, let's just get some general housekeeping out of the way. As always, you can find us at WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can find us across all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, as well as YouTube, and our Patreon, where for as little as $3 a month, you can financially back the show, get some goodies, and become part of the team, part of the family. I'm very excited to report, guys, that I spent the entirety of my weekend researching, writing, and recording. So what does that mean for you? It means that episodes are going to finally be more frequent, and we're going back to current cases. I like to mix it up on this show. I like to do informative episodes, such as the Cannibal series, learning, you know, I hope you learned something. I hope you learned, just as I did, about various types of cannibalism and large cases. The Marilyn Monroe series here has been really informative. Once I become interested in a topic, I like to learn as much about it as I can. But I think it's time to check in on some cases. If you listen to this podcast for the Lori Vallow case, yes, I am aware that there's been some happenings in the Lori Vallow case. Granted, they're more on the legal side. I think it's time for a Lori Vallow update. Likewise, I do believe that the Suzanne Morphew case, that is a case that has impacted me emotionally, very similar to the Gabby Petito case. And I've mentioned it a few times on previous episodes that I do believe that it's going to be a miracle if Barry Morphew is actually convicted of this crime. And I haven't really covered the Suzanne Morphew case since the arrest affidavit was released. So, Lori Vallow coming, Suzanne Morphew coming, and then there are a lot of active current cases going on that I would like to touch on, missing people and so forth. But let's go ahead and get into the Marilyn episode. Side note, guys, my allergies are absolutely killing me and it's hard to breathe. So if you notice a little extra like heavy breathing, I promise I'm not a creep. I promise it's just allergies making it incredibly hard and exceptionally difficult to breathe. But yeah, fun part about spring. But let's go ahead and talk Marilyn Monroe, guys. To start, I want you to just take a moment and think about your life. Is there any world event that acts as a sort of bookmark for you? A moment where it seems as though just everything stands still. And then decades later, you still remember exactly where you were when you heard the news. And I think for everyone in my peer group, I'm 37, you know, I was a junior in high school when 9/11 happened. And I still remember watching the news live in the first class of the day. The sounds, the feeling, the way that where the TV was, the smell of the classroom even. And for my parents, it was the assassination of John F. Kennedy, as well as the moon landing. Now, for episode one, like I said, I covered, you know, Marilyn Monroe's tragic life from her birth to her death. And again, just to recap, when she died, her ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio, was pretty much her only family. I mean, you know, he was the one who flew from New York to LA to begin the funeral arrangements, who identified her body, who organized the funeral, who designed the headstone. And the rumor mill got started almost instantaneously. And I'm talking about on the side of, you know, the public. And as well as Marilyn Monroe's friends, her colleagues in Hollywood, the media didn't really touch on it at all at this point, right after her death. stage fright and anxiety, drugs and alcohol addictions, chronically showing up late to sets, multiple miscarriages, a divorce from Arthur Miller, her one of her last husband. Marilyn Monroe had previously endured a rough few years. That was plain to the world. But it seemed that in 1962 that she was turning her life around. And then with the help of her ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio, she got cleaner. She lost weight. Marilyn Monroe, you know, part of the reason why nowadays she's such an icon is because she pretty much traveled between size 14, 16, like 12 and 16. Size 12 is the smallest that Monroe ever really got while she was an actress in Hollywood. And so she lost weight, got skinny. She stopped drinking and taking drugs at her previous levels. And then she was rehired on the film Something's Got to Give after that nervous breakdown. And her salary went from the equivalent of $100,000 to $500,000. She even bought a home in Brentwood, California for $75,000. Now, to put that in perspective, that's the equivalent of a $780,000 home today. So by all accounts, both pre-death and posthumously, Marilyn Monroe was on top of the world and in super great spirits. And in fact, a lot of her friends, her half-sister, and other people who spoke with her that week of her death said that she just felt great. And it's one of the most commonly asked questions in pop culture. Did Marilyn Monroe commit suicide or was she murdered? Did the drugs and drinking and mental health issues provide a convenient cover for a murder? Or was her death genuinely self-inflicted or accidental? Regardless, on August 5th, 1962, Marilyn Monroe was discovered dead at her home at 12305 Fifth Helena Drive at the age of 36. Here's the generally accepted timeline of events. But here's the thing. Handfuls of people have come out of this case claiming a lot of wild shit. I'm talking LAPD officers who showed up originally on the scene, people who were present at the coroner's office for the autopsy, private investigators, friends, strangers, media. I mean, the list of crazy when it comes to this is not a short one. And almost every single story alters this timeline of events. So what I'm going to cover is the widely accepted timeline of events on the day of her death. And then we can discuss the conspiracy theories surrounding all of this after. So 7 p.m. on August 4th, 1962, Marilyn Monroe called Peter Lawford. Now, Peter Lawford was another huge Hollywood actor, and he also happened to be the brother-in-law to JFK. Yes, John F. Kennedy. He's also the one, if you remember in the first episode, Marilyn Monroe was booked to sing for JFK, the happy birthday, and Peter Lawford is the one who contacted Marilyn and got her to, you know, booked for that. And Marilyn was supposed to have dinner at his house that night, but she actually ended up canceling it. Supposedly around 8 p.m., she went to bed. At midnight, Eunice Murray, Marilyn's longtime housekeeper, claims that she saw a light under the door. And she's like, that's a little strange. Maybe she's up. It was just midnight. She said she woke again around 3:30 in the morning. The light was still on and the door was locked. So Eunice called Ralph Greenson, Marilyn's longtime psychiatrist. Ralph Greenson comes over and he ends up, you know, the door is locked. So he takes a poker, a fireplace poker, walks around to the outside and breaks in the outdoor window to get into Marilyn's room. It was at that point they realized that she was deceased. She was unconscious. They believed her to be dead. So they called her doctor. Her doctor comes. At 3:50 a.m., he officially announced her dead. Now, at 4:25 a.m., Dr. Greenson reports the death to the LAPD. He called the police again. 3:30 a.m. is when Eunice, Marilyn's housekeeper, discovered that she appeared to be unconscious in her room but was locked out. 3:30 a.m. is when Dr. Greenson arrives, breaks in the bedroom, believes she's dead, calls her doctor, and they don't report this to the LAPD until 4:25 in the morning. The LAPD and responding officers, they were there within just a matter of minutes, and they end up taking her body in for the autopsy. They take it. The autopsy was completed by 10:30 in the morning. We're talking about, what, 5.5 hours? And the autopsy said probable suicide. The coroner said that she died by taking a lot of sleeping pills. Like, that was the probable cause for all of this. Here's what's interesting. Here are a few things. So that's the accepted general timeline of the final day and death, right? When she was discovered. So Eunice Murray, Marilyn's housekeeper, said that Marilyn went to bed around 7:30 p.m. that Saturday, August 4th, and that was the last time that she ever saw her alive. Peter Lawford and Joe DiMaggio Jr., Joe DiMaggio's son, both said that they spoke to her on the phone around that time. Eunice Murray knocked on her door around midnight and then called Dr. Ralph Greeson. Now, what's interesting here to me is that Eunice Murray later changed her story and said that the midnight thing, that didn't happen. So I find it really interesting that Eunice Murray initially doubled down and said midnight, she, you know, saw a light on, woke up at 3:30 a.m. in a panic. Later down the road, she made that statement multiple times and later down the road said that that did not happen. This news hit the newspaper on Monday, and the only thing the newspaper said was that she was found nude. And the newspaper, the journalism surrounding her death was actually super sad. You can find obituaries from a variety of magazines and newspapers like Variety and so forth. And it borderline is offensive, the way that they spoke about her. And I think it actually speaks volumes to the celebrity culture at the time, especially of women as well, and how a lot of America saw Marilyn. Now, Marilyn's body, when it was picked up for the autopsy, it was sent to the LA County Coroner's Office. And Thomas Noguchi, an assistant medical examiner, was the one who performed the autopsy, not the chief medical examiner. In a later interview, and I found this so fascinating, a little look into the profession, I guess, is that Noguchi stated that every autopsy performed begins with the assumption that you are examining a murder victim. And he said that the physical examination showed no signs of trauma at all. There was a small bruise on the small of her back. However, due to the location and the coloring of the bruise, he deemed that accidental and not caused by trauma, like, you know, at someone else's hands. The toxicology results showed that her blood contained high levels of chloral hydrate when she died, likely from those sleeping pills and the barbiturate Nembutal. Her autopsy report claimed that the pills caused her death, but here's what's interesting. Her stomach, during the autopsy, they found no trace of capsules from the pills whatsoever. Nada. Nothing. Now, there are various theories as to why that was, such someone like Marilyn who took so much medication. I've seen it theorized by physicians that her stomach, like the pH level and whatnot, that pretty much dissolves immediately. Also because they have such high concentrations of chemicals and, say, chloral hydrate in her case. Nembutal actually has a yellowish sticky residue that it typically leaves behind. There was none of that with her either. Again, Dr. Noguchi said that, well, you know, she basically is an addict, so that makes sense too. But later on, Dr. Noguchi would call for the case to be reopened. And it's really interesting because multiple times he's made statements throughout the years saying, no, it's, you know, it's very cut and dry suicide, very cut and dry suicide, or at least accidental overdose. But then yet he said, well, some stuff is suspicious, so I think that we should reopen it. It just doesn't really make sense. And it's fascinating. Dr. Noguchi would later go on to write a book. He ended up believing that it was just a cut and dry case of suicide, but he does speak in depth as to the science behind how there's really no conspiracy here. What is really interesting is that when the police showed up, right, the police showed up a little after 4:30. Marilyn Monroe's room was stripped. It was stripped bare. Her bed had been stripped. The walls had been cleaned. The surfaces, her nightstand, all of it had been cleaned. The floor had been like swept and cleaned. And her bed sheets were in the wash. Her housekeeper, Eunice Murray, had stripped everything and she was washing her bed sheets in the middle of the night as the police arrived at Marilyn Monroe's home, which is so bizarre. Within 48 hours of Marilyn Monroe's death, a lot of documents were stuffed into shopping bags and removed by Inez Melson, Marilyn's business manager. 2 weeks after Marilyn's death, Eunice actually went to France for 2 weeks. Likewise, her lawyer, Marilyn Monroe's personal attorney, also left the country for a month. And we're talking days after Marilyn Monroe's death, which makes no sense whatsoever in the grand scheme of things to a lot of different people, right? But I feel like in order to discuss the conspiracy theories at all, we kind of have to go over John F. Kennedy because he fits so prominently into all of them, like, well, almost all of them. And I feel like a lot of the more recent generations probably know a lot less about JFK other than the fact that he was assassinated. And I think even then it's a 50-50 shot on whether they've even seen the Zapruder film. But JFK was a very, very, very complex individual. You know, he had a short 2-year presidency. It oversaw massive accomplishments like the founding of the Peace Corps, proposing the Civil Rights Act, and very, very, very aggressive space program spending. I think that we can even likely, you know, if you recall his speech, a lot of people do, that we're going to put a man on the moon. You know, that did end up happening after his death. But he also had major failures like the Bay of Pigs. Americans were just absolutely enthralled with the Kennedy family, particularly Jackie O. It was the first time in American history that the first lady was youthful, exuberant, beautiful, and stylish. I mean, she's known for her style. Kennedy was, and still is, actually by today's standards even, the second youngest president to hold office. I mean, he was sworn in at just 43 years old. Putting her up against all the previous first ladies, Jackie Kennedy was an absolute supermodel in comparison because America at that point had seen, you know, 70-year-old, frumpy, right? Not with their times, kind of behind the times. Not very chic first ladies and, you know, older male presidents. So men wanted to be John F. Kennedy, who was a raging playboy. Everyone knew it. You know, that was not just a rumor. I mean, it was everyone in the world knew that he was a playboy. And then women wanted to be rich and chic like Jackie, well-cultured, well-traveled, beautiful style. I mean, it was huge. And then when John was assassinated in that convertible, people immediately think of certain images now. Jackie crawling over the back seat after the bullet struck, showing up in the airfield to receive his remains in her pink blood-stained suit. 3-year-old JFK Jr. saluting his father's coffin at the funeral. And then Jackie O taught the nation how to grieve after this, showing grace, giving speeches, being elegant, and showing poise throughout the whole ordeal. It was a few days after the assassination that Jackie cemented the Kennedy legacy. She gave an interview to Life magazine, and in the interview, Jackie deliberately quoted John's favorite musical, Camelot. During the interview, she said, quote, "Don't let it be forgot that for one brief shining moment, there was Camelot." And that one sentence alone mythologized the entire Kennedy dynasty. I mean, I had never understood growing up. You know, my parents would talk about it. Everyone talks about it. If you look up the word Camelot right now and Google it, one of the top two like autofill search results is going to be Kennedy's. And that's why that one sentence. But underneath it all, it wasn't grand. John was an epic serial philanderer, just like his father, Joe. And JFK would sleep with up to 10 different women per week, either in the White House, while he was on speaking engagements. He had affairs with celebrities, interns. He even had them bring prostitutes into the White House. And his father, Joe, was a terrible role model and complete and total piece of shit. Joe Kennedy Sr. was born into a rich political family in Massachusetts. His father, PJ Kennedy, so John's grandfather, was a whiskey importer and businessman and politician in the late 1800s. And there is ample evidence showing that he had extensive connections to all kind of mobsters and criminal families from Chicago, Jersey, and Boston. And if you've heard, yes, the mafia and the mob plays a huge role into the death of Marilyn Monroe with like all of these conspiracy theories. But JFK's dad, Joe Kennedy Sr., did briefly live in Chicago, and he added to his insane wealth with bootlegging during Prohibition. And it's more than heavily rumored that Joe Kennedy was a bootlegger, smuggling alcohol during the Prohibition period. He became friends with Al Capone, who would go on to become the co-founder of a group called the Chicago Outfit. The Chicago Outfit is a powerful and violent Italian-American crime syndicate. Now, if you're familiar with the five families of New York City, you know, the five major mob houses, it's very similar, except the Chicago Outfit has never been at war with one another. They've always been a very solid unit, and they're influential all over the country. I mean, as over, you know, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Jersey, like pretty much everywhere. Their reach and their power has diminished greatly, but they're still active today. And it's said, it's widely accepted, really. It's not just said, it's widely accepted that almost any politician who comes up, president or politician, senator, or mayor, anyone in Chicago or even Illinois especially, that you have to be approved of by the Chicago Outfit before you can even run. But you may be asking yourself currently, okay, cool, but why the history lesson? And all I can say is bear with me, because it does actually make sense. Now, the Chicago Outfit, you know, aka the Mafia, supported JFK for president, and they felt betrayed because, if you recall, Robert Kennedy, JFK's younger brother, became the Attorney General of the United States, and his pet project became prosecuting the mob. And the theory goes that the betrayal was so great, the Mafia leaders, Jimmy Hoffa, does that ring a bell? Santos Traficante and Carlos Marcello are the prime suspects, actually like fully behind JFK's assassination. Also, don't forget that JFK had a lot of indirect connections to the Mafia. Let's say all of this is bullshit. JFK still had a lot of connections to the actual mob. One of his best friends was actually Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra was great friends with John F. Kennedy. And if you recall, Frank Sinatra was also best friends with Marilyn Monroe. They actually had a little bit of a love affair as Marilyn Monroe, right after Joe DiMaggio. She and Joe DiMaggio broke up from their first marriage. She lived with Frank Sinatra for a while. Frank Sinatra's involvement with the mob is just freaking legendary. Also, during this time period and whatnot, the mob owned, I mean, debatable on whether it still does or not, but also owned a lot of Las Vegas. And it's fascinating to me. I just like love the history of it. But they owned a lot of the nightclubs, the cabanas, you know, things like that. So it's just all really, truly fascinating. But that is a big piece of a lot of these conspiracy theories. Another piece that plays into these theories is the affair between Marilyn Monroe and JFK. Now, historians have researched this. Guys, there has actually been, like, can you imagine that money has been sent, like federal grants, to study whether Marilyn Monroe fucked JFK? Like, I shit you not, federal grants have been given to historians and people to just see and try to play however many degrees of Kevin Bacon to see if Marilyn Monroe and JFK were ever alone, what kind of evidence has been, you know, shown to see if they have done the deed. And it's widely accepted that Marilyn Monroe and JFK, unlike a lot of popular opinion or, you know, understanding, that they were only around each other four times and they had sex once, and that it meant nothing to either one of them. That is kind of the scholarly agreed upon thing. That being said, a lot of people apparently think that the affair, like the romantic affair, she actually had with Robert Kennedy, Attorney General, younger brother to JFK. And this is something that people immediately thought of at the time when she sang happy birthday, you know, happy birthday to you. That drove the world crazy. At that moment, everyone was like, okay, well, our president's a hoe, so no doubt he's probably banging this actress on the side. And I love the show Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It is probably my favorite show of the last 5 years. And this most recent season, season 4, has Midge, is hired to actually do a stand-up routine at a Jackie O, you know, JFK is running for president and Jackie O is having a little like dinner party or like luncheon for women. And Midge tells a joke about how to had a one night stand with a guy who ended up being married. And then in the show, Jackie O just starts sobbing. People were very hyper aware that JFK would cheat on Jackie all the time. It's really fascinating that all of these different rumors started kind of circulating immediately. No one really deemed Marilyn Monroe's death suspicious until 1964. And that's when Frank A. Capel published a little story called The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. Now, Capel's theory is that Robert Kennedy had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. He told her that he wouldn't leave his wife. Marilyn threatened to go public with the affair, scheduled a press conference for the following day, and then Robert Kennedy dispatched a group of roving communists to kill her, cover it up, and make it look like a suicide. Obviously, that's probably batshit. Frank Capel has also, his ethics and his morality has been called into question a handful of times. So yeah, but that was the very first time that on a public scale, like on a wide scale, that someone came forward and said, this shit is sus. Now, let's talk about Peter Lawford. Peter Lawford was a Hollywood actor, very good looking, soft-spoken. Again, he was a Kennedy brother-in-law, married to his sister, Patricia. And he was the last person to speak with Marilyn Monroe. Now, again, recall that I said that every single person in Marilyn Monroe's orbit, Joe DiMaggio, like, you know, Joe DiMaggio was a piece of shit and he beat her relentlessly. Like every time that they were around her, he would pretty much beat her. They would argue, they would have sex, they would argue, and then he would be aggressive and physically assault her. But the man loved her and worshipped her up into and including until his death, I think in like 1998, like when he died later on in cancer. I mean, it had been 40 years since Marilyn Monroe had died, and he sent flowers to her grave twice a week and visited it like monthly. The man, whatever, but he very much loved her. He even said that she was just like on cloud nine and everything was wonderful. Peter Lawford, again, Kennedy, brother-in-law, was the last to speak with her and said that she said goodbye. He said that she sounded out of it, like she was on drugs. Goodbye, tell Pat goodbye, tell the president goodbye, and goodbye to you. You're a good guy. And then passed out and fell asleep or whatever. Back in 1956, Marilyn told one of her closest friends that she's, quote, afraid of Peter. He might harm me, poison me, etc. So Marilyn Monroe was actually afraid of Peter Lawford, which is interesting. I wish there was more information on that, but there isn't. And her friend who had that context and that quote said that she didn't understand either. Now, speaking of Peter Lawford, Peter Lawford's ex-wife, as well as a personal investigator, Fred O'Tash. Now, Fred O'Tash is a name that you're going to, if you get into the Marilyn Monroe rabbit hole, Fred O'Tash is a private investigator who is just all over this case. He says his claim, as well as Peter Lawford's ex-wife, remember, I mean, she has a dog in the fight. Her ex-husband was supposedly there. They both claim that Peter Lawford and Robert Kennedy were with Marilyn Monroe the night she died, that an argument ensued, and that Marilyn Monroe committed suicide. Then Peter Lawford and Debbie Gould smuggled Robert Kennedy back to Northern California so he would not be connected to her death. Now, it is in fact true that the day that Marilyn Monroe was discovered, that August 5th, that Robert Kennedy was in fact in Northern California. Another theory is that during her time, during her affair with Robert Kennedy, that Marilyn became aware of a confidential CIA plot to assassinate Fidel Castro. So Robert Kennedy dispatched someone from the government and they killed her by injecting her with something and staging it to look like a suicide. Now, Jack Clemens was a homicide investigator on the scene of her death. He was actually the first person from the LAPD to show up at Marilyn Monroe's house. And he claims, and he's gone on countless talk shows, he's written countless articles and books and so on and so forth. He claims that Marilyn Monroe was murdered by a needle injection by someone that she knew and probably trusted. He says, quote, "I do not hesitate at all to call this what it simply is. It is a murder. And I do not hesitate at all to go in to say that a conspiracy existed between the police department, the coroner's office, and between the LA County District Attorney's office to conceal this murder and pass it off as a suicide." Now, Jack Clemens has been on, like I just said, has been on countless talk shows and so forth. One of the most striking things is he went on one particular talk show. It was a primetime documentary called The Marilyn Files. And he recreated and discussed the entire day of Marilyn's death. And like I said, guys, this singular episode on her death and the conspiracy theories could be 40 hours long by itself. So a lot of this is paraphrased. I highly, highly, highly suggest you guys go seek this out. Read these people's books. I mean, Jack Clemens, above all, to me, he was the first on the scene. He was there. He was the first person, like officer, in her bedroom. He says that she had an injection point under her left breast, that it was very clear to him that he saw an injection point under her breast. He said that the crime scene was staged, that's something, you know, with being an officer, that's something that he had experience in, and it was very clearly staged. The housekeeper was cleaning her bed sheets. For what reason? For what purpose? The behavior of the housekeeper, the business manager, and Marilyn's attorney all fleeing the country right after her death, suspicious. You know, and when Marilyn was taken to the coroner's office for the autopsy initially, apparently she was placed in a small closet right off the bat. I'm talking about when she got there, she wasn't taken into an actual room, holding room, morgue, anything like that. Her body was wheeled into a literal closet and then just disappeared and went through the process. But Jack Clemens has written a series of books on this. He has constantly been yelling and screaming for this case to be reopened through the lens of more modern forensics. But he's so close to the case, and he was there, first there. And so I definitely, what he says hits me more deeply, I think. But something that I found really interesting is, in tearing apart the housekeeper and Dr. Greenson's stories, he went on a talk show in like 1991. And on the stage of that talk show, they had a window set up, and it was the same glass from Marilyn Monroe's bedroom window. Supposedly the one that Dr. Greenson had grabbed a poker from the living room fireplace, grabbed the poker, went outside around the house up to Marilyn Monroe's bedroom window and smashed the glass in. And he said, "Look, I've recreated this a billion times." And then he did it for everyone there in the studio. And you see, as all of the glass, there's very little on what would be considered the outside, you know, outdoors. All the glass traveled inward into the room, as it were. And he said that when he got there, within minutes, he knew that this had been a murder and cover up because there was no glass inside Marilyn's bedroom. Had Dr. Greenson supposedly taken the poker and come in the bedroom window that way, the glass would have solely been inside Marilyn Monroe's bedroom. However, all of the glass was still outside underneath the outside windowsill. So, and then he goes through a bunch of other things that, you know, the official story versus what happened. But I find that little detail very interesting and something that maybe, you know, an officer, someone really kind of in the know on that would pick up on. But that was really fascinating to me. And the Marilyn Files, you can actually find that on YouTube in full. They have a lot of people involved in the case actually come speak on why and how they think that this is a cover-up. Another reason is that Marilyn Monroe had a very thorough diary. I believe that it was a little red diary, in fact, that she had kept for years. And in that diary, supposedly, she wrote that she had affairs with both JFK and RFK, and that she wrote U.S. secrets down in her diary. Which, I mean, that's where it ends. She wrote down U.S. secrets, and apparently she was dispatched for doing so. And another one involves Frank Sinatra. This is Frank Sinatra's theory and version. Frank Sinatra was a very interesting person. As I said earlier, he, you know, the crooner thing, when he got his start, he was in a lot of clubs. When he was at his height, the epitome of his career, he was performing in Las Vegas and different cities, casinos and nightclubs, and they were all mob owned. And that's why he had been followed for years. The FBI had a file like 40 miles long on him because of his known affiliations to mobsters and gangsters. Now, there's a 50-50 chance, like opinion, you know, thought of whether he was involved with the mob himself and did help, or if he was kind of, I don't really want to get involved with that, but I have to appease these people because I'm operating in their world and their businesses. Regardless, he had a lot of friends who were mobsters. Now, Frank Sinatra said that his attorney, Mickey Rudin, who also happened to work with Marilyn Monroe, told him that Marilyn had been murdered. His attorney, Mickey, said that Sam Giancana, the infamous Chicago gangster, told him personally that that's exactly what happened. He said that she'd been murdered with a Nimbutal suppository and that Robert Kennedy and or the mob had done it. Frank Sinatra was not sure. He did, however, go to his grave saying that she was, in fact, murdered. Now, another theory is from the book Double Cross. And the authors of this book claim that Marilyn Monroe was actually murdered by the mob, specifically Chicago mafia boss Sam Giancana. Supposedly, she was killed because Robert Kennedy, again, as I said earlier in the episode when we were going over the Kennedys, Robert Kennedy, you know, he was on a crusade against the mafia. And so the mafia killed Marilyn to get back at him, more or less, as a warning of don't fuck with us. And yet another theory, in the book Victim, The Secret Tapes of Marilyn Monroe, the author, Matthew Smith, claims that the CIA knew that Monroe and Robert Kennedy were having an affair, which, honestly, likely, and that the CIA killed her as a sort of revenge at the Kennedy family for the Bay of Pigs, being one of the, if the biggest disaster of the Kennedy presidency. Another theory, yet another theory, is that it was a cover-up by her doctors. She had been pumped so full of pills that it was absolutely ridiculous. She called. Her mental state had been so fragile for so long that she called her Dr. Greenson and others at a drop of a hat. The day that she died, Joe DiMaggio Jr. called her. Now, Joe DiMaggio Jr. was the young son of Joe DiMaggio. If you listen to episode one, you'll remember, I believe he was about 8 years old when she married his father. And so later at that point, you know, he was a couple years older, had a girlfriend. Well, Joe Jr. called Marilyn hour before she perished and said, "Hey, Marilyn, you know, I just want you to know that I dumped my girlfriend that you didn't like." In what world is it normal for someone to call their therapist to say, "Hey, my ex-husband, soon to be again husband's child, dumped his girlfriend that I didn't like. Isn't that pretty cool?" But that's what Marilyn did. Her entire relationship with both her doctor, Greenson, and her physician were very, 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 very codependent. She saw them as absolute helpers, and they pumped her full of every pill imaginable. So another theory is that it was a cover-up by her doctors. And then really quickly, the final theory that I'm going to go over, guys, is from the book Marilyn Monroe, The Biography. And he claims that it was just a simple accidental overdose, which happened because Marilyn Monroe lied to her two doctors about the amount of medication that she had been prescribed. Spoto claims that it makes the most sense because of the housekeeper calling Dr. Greenson, Greenson getting there, trying to get in, not calling the authorities, but calling her other physician, still taking some time before they call police, the washing of the bed sheets, the fact that none of the bottles in the house had pills in them, no pill capsules. And that is kind of his explanation for all of that, that the doctors did not want any responsibility placed on their shoulders for the overprescription of medication. And they, you know, she accidentally killed herself. And then they basically covered it up, staged it as a suicide with the help of Eunice. But these are kind of the biggest schools of thought when it comes to Marilyn Monroe, her death, what happened to her. It's just absolutely terrible and tragic. But I highly suggest, if you guys are itching to get involved in a case and go down a rabbit hole that is just crazier as time goes on, I highly suggest you read about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, her style, her influence, you know, more than 60 years after her death, and she's still an absolute icon. You go into almost any home furnishing store, anywhere for that matter, anywhere, and you will see, you know, an Andy Warhol portrait of her or whatever. I think the part that I'm most bitter about is the fact that Marilyn Monroe actually had a brilliant mind. And we see this so frequently with women today. You know, she loved being around intellectuals, hence why she was married to Arthur Miller. She debated politics. She was actually known to spar visibly with Robert Kennedy over America's policy with Cuba in the civil rights movement. She was a supporter of a sane nuclear policy, which, look that up, S-A-N-E, sane nuclear policy in the 60s. The thing that she was most passionate about was the civil rights movement, equal rights for poor ethnic minorities. The last interview that she did, of course, the journalist was looking for like that catch-all headline, and she stopped them. She demanded that this quote be what it was. And she said, quote, "What I really want to say, that what the world really needs is a feeling of kinship. Everybody, stars, laborers, blacks, Jews, Arabs, we are all brothers. Please don't make me a joke. End the interview with what I believe." I'm so curious if we would have gotten another like Dolly Parton type figure, right? Dolly Parton came out. She has the big hair, the big blonde hair, the big breasts. Let's keep it real. She got surgery to enhance them, the big makeup, and it was one of her early, early, early interviews with Barbara Walters. And she's like, "Look, I know I'm laughed at. I know I'm a joke. I do this to stand out. This is not who I actually am. I know who I am. This is who I portray to be, who I portray myself to be, because I'm an entertainer." And I wonder if Marilyn Monroe was much the same way, because every single thing that anyone has ever said about her who knew her is that behind closed doors, she was Norma Jean. But that's it for today, guys. This is a rabbit hole. It's so interesting and so fascinating. I wonder, will we ever know the reality of what happened? Probably not, I would say. Because to be honest with you, I think our government was, you know, my 2 cents for whatever it's worth, not much, is that yes, that she was likely murdered. I actually do believe that with everything that I have read. I do wholeheartedly believe that Marilyn Monroe was murdered. Curious to know what you guys think. Do you guys think it was just a suicide? Do you think that she was murdered? If so, who by? For me, I think one of the telltale signs is that when her home was purchased like 20 years later and they started doing the renovations, I posted this on our Facebook and our social media, how they found the most complex wiretapping system. Not even just wiretapping, guys. Every single room in her home was tapped, every single one, including the bathrooms, were tapped by wires. And it was from the CIA. Now, I don't think that this was just from the communism scare. I think that Marilyn Monroe, whatever she was into, whether it was an affair or something more, she was perceived as a very big threat. But I want to know what you guys think. But that's it for today, guys. Coming up next, like I said, we're going to get back into Suzanne Morphew with a state of the case update. Same thing with Lori Vallow. And then there's some missing persons cases that I would like to give some visibility to. So we will be going through that coming up over the next week. Again, you can find us at wesawthedevil.com. From there, you can go across all social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and then also our Patreon. If you're digging the show, want to financially back it, you can do so there. Until next crime.